Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network and New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, and today I'll be joined by Adam Fabry, who is a lecturer of political economy at the National University of Chilecito in Argentina. Thanks for joining us today, Adam.
Hi. Hello, everybody, and thank you very much, Stephen, for inviting me to the podcast.
So I'm really excited to talk about Adam's new book. We're coming to you between San Diego and Argentina. This is exciting for me. His new book is called The Political Economy of Hungary, From State Capitalism to Authoritarian Neoliberalism, published by Palgrave in 2019. A little bit about Adam. He received his PhD from Brunel University in the UK under the supervision of Gareth Dale. Adam's research interests include international political economy, uneven and combined development, neoliberalism, and the history and politics of the far right, with a regional focus on Central Eastern Europe and Latin America. His work has been published in many international journals, including Capital and Class, Competition and Change, Historical Materialism, and a recent really interesting article I read by Adam in Jacobin. So I want to start with a couple of big questions, because this is a complex and as I like it, multi-scalar book. Adam, could you begin by telling us what you mean by neoliberalism? It's such a contested term, and I think, as you rightly put it, it's almost like an academic F word, right? What is it, and what is your working understanding of it?
That's a very important and a huge question, of course. I think it's important to say from the beginning that my understanding of neoliberalism has evolved over the years, and it's something that I'm continuously working on. I would say that my interpretation is three-layered, I would say. So on the one hand, we can see neoliberalism, of course, as an ideology, a contradictory one, rhetorically promotes, of course, the self-regulation of markets, but at the same time, for instance, is actively advocating for state intervention when markets fail, or in order to promote the extension of markets in areas which haven't been governed by the logic of the market. So that's one level, and that's normally a level which heterodox economists focus on, for instance, Stiglitz and so on and so forth. But then there is also a political element to neoliberalism, which I think, for instance, David Harvey has shown that neoliberalism is also a class project in a sense. No, so it's actively advocating the interests of capitalist class throughout the world. However, there is also a third layer to neoliberalism, as far as I see it, and that's perhaps you can sum it up by seeing it as the current phase of capitalism, as capitalism has evolved since the 1970s onwards. And it's a phase characterized by financialization, by the commodification, the increase in commodification of the commons through privatizations and so on and so forth, and the regressive redistribution of wealth and so on and so forth, and attacks on trade unions and social collectives throughout the world. So, that would be my summary of neoliberalism.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent start. And I think it's really important, as you say, right from the beginning, to talk about neoliberalism in the plural, the varieties of neoliberalism, and some of their limitations through various crises. So, I want to ask a question about the design of your book, because I see your book moving through maybe 75 years of economic history. And of course, the centerpiece of this is Orban's regime. So because we're on a podcast and not doing an interview by text, I will give you the option of moving forward or backward in time. To talk about either 1945 or 2020 and 2021, let's try to move toward Orban. How do you conceptualize your book? I know you have five chapters, and you end in this particular moment of what I think, interestingly, you call authoritarian ethnicist neoliberalism.
My book is basically an extension, a revision of my PhD. My PhD was basically attempting to answer a number of questions. On the one hand, there is the question of, how does neoliberalism arrive to Hungary and to other Soviet bloc economies, which have officially been closed off from the rest of the world for 60 years or so now. Another interesting question, of course, and highly topical as we speak today, is, how do you explain the rise of what some people call illiberal, or what I would call an authoritarian ethnicist regime, such as the one as Orban, in the last decade or so. So,
right.
Those are some of the questions that I'm grappling with in the book, and I think. The way I'm looking at it is that you need to, in order to explain Orban, you need to have an understanding of what has happened in Hungary and elsewhere in the region, not only since the transition in 1989, but also how neoliberalism was emerging before that period.
Right. And I find it interesting what you do, because you delve very deeply into the context in Hungary, particularly in the period from 1956 to 1968, well before the crisis of 1973 or the foreign debt crisis in the Warsaw Pact countries. So how was it that you delved into Hungarian schools and sources? And could you introduce them, who they are, especially who these economists were, in that early kind of period, that what you would probably call the longue durée of Hungarian economic history? How far back do you go, and who are they, and what do you do?
Why I'm doing that is because I want to avoid this sort of dominant but quite cliché explanation of economic history within the Soviet bloc, which basically assumes that throughout the whole Soviet bloc, you had a sort of very and the central planning was universal, and you didn't have any contrasting any debates between economies of how to reform or improve the economic structure.
And it's a Stalinist myth, right? I mean, it's one of the big Stalinist claims after 1949. Sorry, go ahead.
Exactly. And so basically, what I'm doing is I'm looking at the debates that emerge in Hungarian society, especially amongst economists, in key moments such as around the opening, the brief opening that emerges with Imre Nagy coming to power in 1953. Until the Hungarian Revolution is crushed in 1956. And then there is another reform debate emerging in the around the development of a new economic mechanism in 1968. And a third reform wave, as the literature has it, from the late 1970s onwards. And I look at these different debates and how they feed on to each other. So, for instance, the reform economists that were working on the new economic mechanism were borrowing heavily from the ideas of some of the key reformers within Imre Nagy's government. But I also look at what were the relationships that these reform economists had with the outside world. And I'm not the only one doing this. I mean, for instance, Johanna Bockmann has written an entire book about this.
Right.
Agnes Kodzi, another Hungarian scholar, has written about this as well recently. And basically, we're all, from different theoretical and perspectives, coming to a conclusion which shows that, especially in the case of Hungary, economists were very much plugged into a wider debates, international debates, from the 1960s onwards, and this, of course, contributed highly to why what I call in the book proto neoliberal ideas emerge so easily in Hungary. Already well before the downfall.
That is my next question. So it's a perfect segue into proto-neoliberalism. This I have not heard of. And I wonder if our listeners could familiarize themselves with the term as you're using it to explain a lot of the debates, especially the debates that are happening in the 1960s and so forth, because right. I mean, there is this stereotype about the emphasis on heavy industry, but how do you come at proto-neoliberalism in dialogue with the world economy, and especially in your focus on the reform economists, as you mentioned? What do you do in your book Shakespeare chapters to emphasize that.
So basically, what is in terms of the Hungarian economy but the whole Soviet bloc as a whole, from the 1960s onwards, there is an increasing crisis of capital accumulation as a result of the limitations of a model which has emphasized a form of policies similar to primitive accumulation earlier achieved in the West in the 18th and 19th centuries. As these limitations become evident, the debates among reform economists in Hungary start to emphasize the introduction of, on the one hand, a greater integration with the world economy, and the introduction of market reforms. So, for instance, the reduction of central planning, greater autonomy for enterprises in terms of the allocation, the production and investment decisions. For instance, the new economic mechanism of 1968 rewrites the labor law to promote greater efficiency and profitability of enterprises. Now, these are policies that you wouldn't really associate with a state socialist or
or a
communist regime, no?
Yes.
And in the case of Hungary, there are even joint ventures being allowed following the new economic mechanism with Western multinationals. So these are the inceptions of what would go on to become, some of the central tenets of neoliberalism in the following the regime change. And I think it's important to trace them all the way back to this period, because it shows that, on the one hand, as I said, Hungarian economists were very well integrated into the international epistemic community, and their ideas of how to reform the system were, of course, influenced by the debates that they had with economists in the West.
And I'm thinking about the role of the Budapest School of Marxists. You know, I mean, Agnes Heller, of course, and Marcus and Hegedus. Were these sort of members of the Budapest School of Marxism involved in these radical left debates? I mean, of course, they're dismissed. But what happens after, let's say, 1968? To them and to some of these debates that you're talking about through the 70s.
Yeah, I think that's it's a very good question. It's important to emphasize that the new economic mechanism, what it does is that it opens up a space for debate which I mean, of course, was unimaginable following the crushing of the Hungarian Revolution. So of course we see the emergence of on the one hand we see the emergence of these proto-neoliberal ideas, and I would say that it's they are dominant. So in terms of at least economic debates, they are absolutely dominant. There is not very much in terms of radical left-wing perspective being put forward in terms of how to reforming the economy. The Budapest School, of course, is very important in terms of its contributions to Marxist philosophy, but it's but the regime is absolutely it's frightened about the possible impacts that the Budapest School might have on workers, on wider on the working class. So in the early 70s, that they stamped down on the Budapest School. Some of the members leave the country, and so on and so forth. And what's left is basically the pro-market economists seek their hiding in different research institutions. But their ideas are developed. But in terms of any left-wing alternative to the regime, those ideas fade fairly quickly. So by the 1980s, there are very few groups promoting a sort of left-wing alternative to the regime.
And you mentioned Johanna Buchmann's work. And I think you're indebted, correct me if I'm wrong, pretty heavily to Gramsci. I'm thinking about the Dimitrov Square Boys and the members of the group really who take part in reform debates. Could you introduce them, some of these institutional, almost like technocrats, right? I mean, they're experts and technocrats who become organic intellectuals, but you describe them in a very interesting way as neoliberals or proto-neoliberals. So by name, who were they and what are their institutes and what do they do through the mid-80s?
Yeah, so basically in one of the chapters of my book, I analyze, I focus very heavily on what I would regard as the key intellectual citadel of proto-neoliberal or neoliberal ideas in Hungary prior to 1989, and that's the Financial Research Institute, known in Hungarian as the Pénzügy Kutatóintézet. And most people who've done work on Hungary or are from Hungary, they would immediately associate the people that I'm going to mention now as some of the leading figures of neoliberalism in Hungary. So, for instance, you have people like Lajos Bokros, György Surányi, Matolcsi, Tardos, Kupa, etc. These are all intellectuals / later on politicians who play a key role in the ascendancy and later on the consolidation of neoliberal ideas in Hungary. I mean, it's quite impressive that a small research institute, which was only founded in 1968, has, I think, three or four of the finance ministers of Hungary following 1990 come from this research institute, several of the heads of the central bank, and so on and so forth. So it's really a key center for the development of neoliberal ideas in Hungary. And the economists that worked at this institute, it's interesting to note that on the one hand, they were well trained in neoclassical economics, which they received from their schooling at the Karl Marx University.
I can imagine how appropriate at the Karl Marx University, right?
Yeah. Yes. And they were officially technocratic in their sort of worldview, but they harbored very close connections with reform circles in the MSMP, with dissident circles, and also with international financial circles. So several of these economists, they went to the West in the 70s and the 80s. They had spells in the IMF, the World Bank, and so on and so forth. And that's really where they developed their ideas.
Yeah. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'm really fascinated by how you do this in your book because take, for instance, Matolcsi, right? He's the minister of economy and a very important figure, but he's the minister of economy during the first and second Orban governments, Matolcsi George. And he's someone who's initially, let's say, he has an advocacy for privatization, and then he becomes critical of capitalism, and then he switches back again. So, you know, I'm interested because if you take someone like Matolcsi and his career and his relationship with Orban and Fidesz, I mean, how flexible are these ideas? Is it just a matter of taking a position and then changing it and adapting it to the regime at a particular moment in time? Or let's say, are these true believers like in the Jeffrey Sachs kind of mold in a particular approach to the world economy? I'm interested in your characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my answer would be that in the case of the Financial Research Institute economists, you can find both. So you can, on the one hand, find people like Bokros, Lajos Bokros, who have been already from the mid-80s onward, been very, very dogmatic in their in the neoliberal beliefs, no? And his career sort of reflects the different waves of neoliberalism or the different periods of neoliberalism quite well. So he was very popular in the 80s and 90s. But as neoliberalism became, the social cost of neoliberalism became increasingly higher and higher, his political career faded. Mm-hmm. And then you have people like you mentioned, Matolcsi, who, exactly as you said, in the late 1980s was an advocate of spontaneous privatization. Has been able to change his beliefs pretty much depending on where the wind blows, by the time he enters the Orban government, he's an advocate of increasing state intervention in the economy, and so on and so forth, and so he's really one of these characters that seem to be quite flexible in terms of his beliefs.
Right. Oh, okay. So I want to switch to 1989 and beyond 1989. So the first question here is what is the significance of 1989 in your book? And the second question is about privatization. So there are many phases, as you say correctly, I think, of the privatization of the Hungarian economy. So how then does that proceed, let's say, from 1990 forward and at least through the so-called golden age or the boom years up to the mid-2000s?
Yeah. Okay. So, 1989, the answer to that question, I would probably have responded differently to that question if you would have asked me maybe 2 decades ago.
So, sure.
Most people in Central and Eastern Europe would probably have responded differently as well. I think 1989, as far as I see it, today, of course, remains a highly important historical date. But at the same time, I think it's important to acknowledge that a large part of the transition, economic and political transition, had already begun prior to that date, which means that the outcomes, the possible outcomes of the revolutionary wave of 89 were very limited. So I think it's important to bear that in mind.
How do you mean that, Adam? I mean, where, what sectors of the economy would you focus on to emphasize that point?
Well, so if we look at privatization, for instance, I mean, privatization had already begun before 1989, although in very shady ways. The Hungarian economy was all so heavily indebted by 1989 that the options available to any democratic government assuming power were very limited, and that's also important to remember. So that made, of course, the introduction of neoliberal reforms much not straightforward, but much easier in a sense. And we also have to remember that here in Latin America, for instance, there wasn't a strong social movement or strong trade unions, independent trade unions, present advocating for alternatives to neoliberal shock therapy.
I'm thinking about the power of people like Klaus and Gaidar and Balcerowicz. So the alternatives that exist toward privatization, what are they? I mean, what are they, let's say, in these phases that you're discussing? Because, as you say, I think probably right, you know, the privatization of the Hungarian economy may have been 60-70% before 1989. So it's not exactly a shock what comes in the early 90s, but it certainly is transformative through the International Monetary Fund, right?
Yeah. Basically, the first government that comes to power in Hungary after the transition is a conservative center-right government coalition, as I said, because of the pressures, the external pressures in terms of foreign debt indebtedness and so on and so forth, they accept privatization, the selling of the so-called crown jewels of the economy, pretty much without hesitation. Up until there is a split in the main party of the right-wing coalition in 1993, as a reaction to the privatization and the selling out of the almost the entire economy to the foreign capital. And as a result of that, there is a brief sort of interregnum between 1993 and 94 in which privatization is stopped, or there is an attempt at least to try to promote the development of national capital.
I mean, comparatively, if you look at the other Central and East European economies, how do you understand this particular moment of, let's say, the late economic boom before the Great Recession hit, right? Because there is the EU-10 enlargement in so-called post-communist states. Do you still read this as a boom period for Hungary going into, let's say, 2005, 2006, 2007, you seem to offer a really unique revisionist perspective on that moment.
Yeah. So what you would normally hear, the sort of the mainstream narrative of the period between late 1990s and up until the Great Recession, is that this is, as you said, a veritable boom period throughout the region. It's a period in which the economies of the region are catching up with the West and so on and so forth. And that is, to a certain extent, true. Economic growth in the EU 10 economies is three times higher than the old EU 15 economies. But of course, that's purely looking at GDP growth per year. So if we dig deeper, behind these figures, then we see that these, on the one hand, this boom is the basis of this boom is capital inflows from predominantly international banks lending heavily to the region, which of course is will then turn out to be very put these economies in a very vulnerable position once the financial crisis hits. But also the boom period masks heavy inequalities, not only income inequalities in these economies, but also increasing regional inequalities. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting there, I think, is that throughout the region, the areas that are sort of left behind in this boom period are the former industrial heartlands of the state socialist period. And this is right. Eventually where where the far right or the liberals have their strongest support.
Base of support. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I want to talk about that with you, because we're skirting around the elephant in the room, who is of course Orban and his career. So I mean everything in many, like, from market fundamentalism on backwards, so-called, it's a lead up to Orban and Orbanismus. But I want you to talk about your conceptualization of his career, because you take him seriously, and many of the speeches that he gives, including the 2010 Jamboree speech about how Western capitalism has failed. So how do you, let's say, as an evolutionary sociologist and a political economist and a historian, put Orban in a new context? What is it that your book does?
I think Orban, in a way, I mean, it doesn't really make sense to, for me, this... what a lot of the sort of the dominant view of Orban as, you know, as some rogue leader, you know, or as some people call him, a modern day mafioso who, you know, just promotes his own economic interests and those of his closest family and friends.
Yeah, Roland Madjar's work for that, right? The post-communist mafia state.
Yeah, exactly, because... It sort of fails to put Orban within a broader context. You know, I mean, it's not like Orban emerges out of nowhere, and it's not like his economic policies are you know, he's just playing around with an economic toolbox without any relationship to what's going on in the wider world economy. And that's why I think it is important to have a clear understanding of his whole political career, because then, for instance, we can see that this authoritarian slide in the case of Orban, is much, 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 much deeper. It goes back all the way back to the mid-90s. So it's not like he woke up in 2010 and said, oh, you know what, I'm going to construct a liberal regime in Hungary.
That's my question. I mean, I'm wondering if there is a defined Orbanomics. Is there something that you can call Orbanomics, like Reaganomics, or there is no alternative in the Thatcher years? Is there something definable that you can trace over time up to exactly what, you know, the regime does by the mid-2010s when they introduce these regressive policies and the flat tax and those other things? Right. I mean, can you define it? Because there are some unusual things within Orban's policies eventually after, you know, they begin passing the legislations.
Yeah, I think, one key, I actually quote quite extensively and a biography that was written on Orban following his electoral defeat in 1994 by a Hungarian journalist called József Debreceni. And in that interview, at one stage he outlines his vision of how to restructure the Hungarian economy, and basically he says quite very very openly, you know, what we need to do is to centralize power in the hands of the executive, and then allow or promote a couple of strong national capitalists to dominate key sectors of the economy. And if you look at what he's been doing since 2010, then that's definitely, you know, one continuity in that sense. Now, of course, his ability to do so is very much limited by external constraints. So it's not like he can just, you know, say to BMW and Mercedes and Audi that, you know, from tomorrow I'm going to take over your factories and I'm going to allow some of my closest friends and allies to run these factories instead, but that's definitely one of the continuities.
And I'm interested in those parallels between Latin American economies because, you know, I mean, you write again in your later chapters that the consolidation of the Orban regime is an excellent chapter I'd recommend about these multinational corporations. So you've got Microsoft and Suzuki and Audi and I forget the others, General Electric. But, you know, I mean, German business loves Orban, and this is often forgotten, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but what are some of the parallels that you see with this really like a sellout to multinational corporations?
Well, on the one hand, I'm sorry to disappoint my liberal friends or liberal listeners to this podcast who were hoping that finally the EU were going to put its foot down against Orban and the Law and Justice Party government in Poland with regards to the new budget discussions that doesn't seem to have happened, and it hasn't happened for the simple reason as you say that Hungary foreign investors is pretty much a paradise, you know. It offers significantly lower labor costs compared to the core capitalist states in the West. It offers the right to repatriate profits and so on and so forth. And, you know, labor is kept very much under control through a government that is increasingly authoritarian as by the day. So
the absence of trade unions and health and education, healthcare, and those sorts of things. I mean, workers' rights are practically non-existent under Fidesz and the coalition. How do you see this then going forward with how well these liberal politics function in the authoritarian ethnicist state? We have to talk about some of the intersections between economics and culture. So how do you envision that? Because, you know, obviously our listeners are going to tune into this and they're going to want to hear about Soros and CEU and the various things that are happening in Budapest. But I mean, your book expands well beyond that into both macroeconomics and culture.
There have been times in the last decade where even I have had to pinch myself because some of the conspiracy theories, for instance, emerging from Budapest are just, you know, beyond belief. It's also when you remember how Fidesz was actively advocating against these very sort of far right conspiracy theories in parliament in the early 1990s, then it's even more sad in a sense to see what's happening in Hungary these days. I think we have to look beyond Hungary and, in a sense, look beyond the region as well, because I think we are very much Orbán is very much showing a possible path. I'm not saying this is going to be the path forward, but it's very much showing a possible path forward on a global scale for capitalism. And so in that sense, I think it's important to pay attention to developments in Hungary and link them to developments elsewhere as well.
What role do you see, Adam? I have to ask it, but what role do you see for the EU? Because, you know, you've got some beneficiaries from Fidesz. If you describe them as neoconservative, I'm not sure, but the far right, Jobbik, you know, sometimes they're in the opposition and sometimes they're benefiting from these policies, especially since the two-thirds supermajority, right, in the 2018 elections. Mm. So where does the EU function in this? Is it just a malfunctioning organization by this moment, judging from Hungary and Poland? And what are the parallels that you see?
Personally, I don't have very high expectations of the EU intervening in any substantial way in Hungary or in Poland, for that matter, either. Simply because, I mean, that's not what the EU was made up to do in the first place. So a lot of times, and I think this, you know, a lot of people on the left still have illusions of the EU being sort of there is a possibility to reform the EU, to promote sort of a more social welfare agenda within the EU. But that's not really what the EU was constructed to do from the beginning. And they're very important breaks that on different institutional levels that stop the EU from actually pursuing a more progressive agenda. I don't really see the EU having neither the ability nor the interest to intervene.
From that angle, could you suggest Marxist political economists? I mean, there's the work, of course, of Tariq Ali, this very influential idea of the extreme center, right? I mean, to understand, you know, from New Left, but really from leftist circles and Marxist circles, the importance of what has happened with the abolition of constitutional checks and balances and the whipping up of the xenophobia. But what do you see as the intellectual contribution of Marxist political economists to this dialogue?
There's been excellent contributions, for instance, from several Greek Marxists. So Kostas Lapavitsas has written an entire book on offering sort of a left-wing critique, a Marxist critique of the EU. My good friend Stathis Kovilakis has also written several. He wrote several excellent pieces in New Left Review at the height of the Greek crisis, and sort of very clearly outlining the limitations of the EU. Also the late, I have to mention the late Neil Davidson, who passed away earlier this year, who wrote also extensively on the limitations of the EU.
Yeah, and in journals like Critical Sociology, for instance, on the far right.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last question I really have for you before I ask you about your current work. If you could predict, I don't know if you could predict, but the history of the 2020s in Hungary and Central and Eastern Europe, do you see the entrenchment of this kind of group of, I don't want to call them mafiosi, but they are oligarchs, and maybe a handful of them. Do you see a pattern for Orbanism happening, not just in Hungary, but elsewhere around the world as the far right continues to be ascendant?
I think that, as I mentioned earlier, there is definitely, Orbanism definitely, has a future, you know, not just in the region, but also globally. So, for instance, I think we can, you know, Trump and Bolsonaro and these kind of characters, they're not going to go away from one day to another, even though Trump seems to has lost the election. They're not going to go away from one day to another, and they're not going to go away, especially. Because the contradictions that the deepening of neoliberalism, neoliberal policies, the impact of these policies. Even let's suppose that Orbán will be defeated in the 2022 elections. I mean the government
That's my question.
The alternative coalition that it currently exists in Hungary includes everything from Jobbik, sort of ex far right, to extreme centrists like Gyurcsány, you know, and these people are most probably not going to introduce very progressive social policies. On the one hand, because they don't want to. On the other hand, because they won't be able to because of the external pressures from the EU and so on and so forth. I think that on the one hand, you know, if some days when I wake up, I would say the future looks looks very bleak. But on the other hand, it's also important to acknowledge that there are important limitations to this model that Orbán is developing. So, you know, COVID has imposed, has made blatantly clear that, you know, the Hungarian healthcare system has been completely underfunded under the Orbán regime, and it's a serious it's causing a serious health crisis, you know. And it's a question how long people will tolerate this in Hungary. What I don't see emerging, at least in Hungary, I mean, Poland is a different case altogether, but what I don't see emerging in Hungary at the moment is a strong critical sort of left-wing alternative based in social movements with relations to independent trade unions and so on and so forth. That is not happening in Hungary today. There are important intellectual contributions emerging. You know, so there are more and more critical political economists writing on the Orbán regime and so on and so forth. But
right.
there is no sort of mass force that would be able to topple the regime.
I know a lot of people are looking for that and wondering what its headquarters could be. So in the last two minutes, could you tell us about your current projects or research, if you're working on a current book or article?
I just finished actually an article which compares the different types of authoritarian neoliberalism in Hungary and Poland. That's coming out just before Christmas, I think, in the Journal of Australian Political Economy. I'm also working on a little article with Cornel Ban, an excellent political economist from Romania, which looks at economic nationalism in Central and Eastern Europe in the last decade. And there are, of course, some pieces that should be focusing more on Latin American developments and neoliberalism in Argentina. But
yeah, I would really love to read that. And I hope those comparisons not only are made, but that there's a wide audience for the publication of books like that, and you'll continue to work on it. So I want to take this moment to identify myself and Adam. We've been speaking with Adam Fabry, who is a lecturer of political economy in Argentina, and his new book is called The Political Economy of Hungary, From State Capitalism to Authoritarian Neoliberalism. This is published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2019. Thank you so much, Adam, for being on the New Books Network podcast with me today. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you very much.